The voice on the bullhorn gave a sharp order in dialect to prevent him striking him again, and they closed on either side of him and forced him to his feet. One of them searched him swiftly, stripping him of knife, belt and emergency pack, and patting his pockets. Then they backed off, leaving him naked except for his khaki shorts and felskun, but they kept their AKs aimed at his belly. The light bobbed as the man carrying it advanced out of the wall of bush. Sean saw that it was one of those portable battle lights powered by a heavy rechargeable battery pack that the man carried on his back. Slightly behind him, keeping back in the shadow, came the man with the bullhorn. Even through the dazzling beam of the battle light, Sean saw that he was tall and lean and that he moved with a cat-like grace. "It's been a long time, Colonel Courtney." He was close enough not to have to use the bullhorn, and Sean recognized his voice. "Many years," Sean agreed. "You'll have to speak up." The man stopped a few paces in front of Sean and jokingly cupped one hand to the side of his head. "I am deaf in one ear, you know," he said, and Sean grinned sardonically at him through his black camouflage cream. "I should have done a better job and blown your other ear out while I was about it, Comrade China." "Yes," China agreed. "We really must discuss old times together." He smiled, and he was even more handsome than Sean remembered, relaxed and charming and debonair. "However, I'm afraid you have delayed me a little, Colonel. Pleasant though it is to renew acquaintance, I cannot afford more time away from my headquarters. There will be an opportunity to talk later, but now I must leave you. My men will take good care of you." He turned and disappeared into the darkness beyond the beam of light. Sean wanted to call after him. "My men, the girl, are they safe?" But he restrained himself. With a man like this, it was best to show no weakness, to give him nothing he could use to his advantage later. Sean forced himself to remain silent when the guards urged him forward with practiced use of their gun butts. "We'll join the main column soon," Sean comforted himself, "and I'll see for myself how Claudia and Job are doing." The thought of Claudia was a refreshing draught that he craved even more than sweet, cool water. There were 10 men in his guard detail under the command of a sergeant. Obviously they were picked troops, powerful and lean as the pack of wolves of his nightmare. Soon they intercepted a well-beaten footpath, and they closed up around him and urged him to a jog trot heading southwards into the night. None of his captors spoke. It was an eerie experience, just the sound of their light footfalls and quick, shallow breathing, the creak of equipment, and the hot, feral smell of their bodies close around him in the night. After an hour, the sergeant signalled a pause, and they stopped beside the track. Sean reached across to the nearest gorilla and tapped the water bottle on his belt. The man spoke to the sergeant. The first words since they had started, and Sean understood him. He was speaking Shangani. The Shanganis were the remnants of one of the tiny Zulu tribes that had been defeated by King Chaka's impis at the Battle of the Mhlatuze River in 1818. Unlike so many of the other lesser chieftains, Soshangani had resisted incorporation into Chaka's empire and fled northwards with his shattered impis to found his own kingdom along the borders of present-day Zimbabwe and Mozambique. So the Shangani language was Zulu-based, and over the years, many of Sean's camp staff had been Shangani, for like their Zulu ancestors, they were a fine and noble people. Sean spoke their language fluently, for it contained many similarities to Sindabili. He did not, however, make the mistake of letting his captors know this, and gave no indication of having understood. As the trooper said, "The Mabanu wants to drink." "Give it to him," the sergeant replied. "You know the Inkosi wants him alive." The man handed Sean the bottle, and though the water was brackish and was tainted by swamp mud, to Sean it tasted like chilled Veuve Clicquot served in a crystal glass. "The Inkosi wants him alive," the sergeant had said. Sean pondered that as he handed the bottle back. The Inkosi, or chief, was obviously Comrade China, and they had orders to care for him. That gave him a little comfort, but he did not have long to savour it. After only a few minutes, the sergeant gave the order, and they resumed their mile-eating jog-trot towards the south. They ran up the Dawn, and at any moment Sean expected them to overhaul the main column which was holding Claudia and Job captive. But mile succeeded mile without any sign of them. Now that it was light, Sean could look for the tracks of the column on the footpath ahead, but there were none. They must have taken a different route. The sergeant in charge was a veteran. He had flankers outsweeping the verges of the footpath ahead for an ambush by Frelimo. But what seemed to concern him more than attack from the forests was the menace from the sky. At all times they attempted to keep under the canopy of the forest, and whenever they were forced to cross open ground, they stopped and searched the sky, listened for the sound of engines before venturing out, and then they crossed to the next line of trees at a full run. Once, during the first morning, they heard the sound of a turbo aircraft engine, faint and very far off, but instantly the sergeant gave an order and they all dived under cover. A trooper lay on each side of Sean and forced him to keep his head down and his face to the ground until the last murmur of the aircraft engine faded. This preoccupation with aerial attack puzzled Sean. All he had heard and read indicated that Frelimo's air force was so weak and scattered as to be almost non-existent. The types of aircraft they possessed were obsolete and unsuited to ground attack, and the shortage of skilled technicians and spares only compounded their ineffectuality. These men, however, were taking the threat very seriously indeed. At midday, the sergeant ordered a halt. One of the troopers prepared food on a small fire, which he doused as soon as it was cooked. They moved on a few miles before stopping once more to eat the meal. Sean was given an equal share. The maize meal was cooked stiff and fluffy and was well salted, but the meat was rancid and on the point of putrefying. In the average white man, it would have caused an immediate attack of enteritis, but Sean's stomach was as conditioned as any African's. He ate it without relish, but without trepidation either. "The food is good," the sergeant told Sean in Shangani as he sat beside him. "Do you want more?" Sean made a pantomime of incomprehension and said in English, "I'm sorry, I don't know what you're saying." The sergeant shrugged and went on eating. A few minutes later, he turned back to Sean and said sharply, "Look behind you, there's a snake." Sean resisted the natural impulse to jump to his feet and instead grinned ingratiatingly and repeated, "I'm sorry, I don't understand." The sergeant relaxed, and one of his men remarked, "He does not understand Shangani. It's all right to speak in front of him." They ignored him for the remainder of the meal and chatted amongst themselves. But as soon as they had finished, the sergeant produced a pair of light manacles from his pack and locked one side onto Sean's wrist and the other onto his own. He delegated sentry duty to two of his men, and the rest of them settled down to sleep. Despite Sean's exhaustion, he'd been going for days now on only brief snatches of sleep. He lay awake and pondered all he had learned and the missing pieces of the puzzle. He was still not certain that he was in Renamo hands. He had only Claudia's brief note to suggest that. On the other hand, Comrade China had been a commissar in Robert Mugabe's Marxist Zanla army. But Renamo was a rabidly anti-communist organization committed to the overthrow of the Marxist Frelimo government. That didn't add up correctly. Furthermore, China had fought the Rhodesian army of Ian Smith. What was he doing here across the border, involved in another struggle in a foreign country? Was China a soldier of fortune, a turncoat, or an independent warlord taking advantage of the Mozambican chaos for his own private ends? It would be interesting to find out. With all this to think about, still his last thought before sleep finally overcame him was of Claudia Montero. If China wanted him alive, then it was highly probable that he wanted the girl alive as well. With that thought, he fell into a deep, dark sleep with a faint smile on his lips. He woke to the ache of abused muscles and the bruises left by gun butts, but the sergeant had him up and running immediately southwards again into the cool shades of evening. Within a mile, his muscles warmed and the stiffness evaporated. He settled into the run, matching his escorts easily. Always he looked ahead, hoping at any moment to see the trail of the main column emerge from the darkness ahead and to see Job and Idan carrying Claudia's litter. They ran through the night, and when they stopped again to eat, his captors began to discuss him through their mouthfuls of maize and high-smelling meat. "They say that in the other war he was a lion, an eater of men," the sergeant told them. "It was he that led the attack at Inflozane, the training camp at the hills of the Maiden's Breasts." The troopers looked at him with interest and dawning respect. "They say that it was veritably he in person who destroyed one ear of General China." They chuckled and shook their heads. That was a fine joke. "He has the body of a warrior," said one of them. And they considered him frankly, discussing his physique as though he were an inanimate object. "Why has General China ordered this?" another asked. And the sergeant grinned and picked a shred of meat from his back teeth with a fingernail. "We must run the pride and anger out of him," he grinned. "General China wants us to change him from a lion into a dog who will wag his tail and do his bidding." "He has the body of a warrior," the first man repeated. "Now we must discover if he has the heart of a warrior." And they all laughed again. "So, it's a contest then." Sean kept his face impassive. "All right, you bastards. Let's see which dog wags its tail first." In a perverse fashion, Sean began to enjoy himself. The challenge was much to his taste. There were 10 of them, all in their 20s. He was just over 40 years of age, but that handicap made it even sweeter and helped him to endure the monotony and hardship of the days that followed. He was careful not to let them know that he understood that this was a contest. He knew it was dangerous to antagonize or humiliate them. Their goodwill and respect would be more valuable than their hatred and resentment. Sean had spent his entire adult life in the close company of black men. He knew them as servants and as equals, as hunters and soldiers, as good and loyal friends and as bitter, cruel enemies. He knew their strengths and weaknesses and how to exploit them. He understood their tribal customs, their social etiquette. He knew how to flatter and please and impress them, how to gain their respect and make himself agreeable to them. He showed them just the right degree of respect, but not enough to make them contemptuous. He took especial care not to challenge the sergeant's authority or force him to lose face in front of his men. He made the most of their sense of humour and of fun. With sign language and a little clowning, he made them laugh. And once they laughed with him, their whole relationship altered subtly. He became more a companion than a captive, and they no longer used the steel-edged gun butts as instruments of casual persuasion. Most importantly, he was every day picking up little snippets of information. Twice they passed burned-out villages. The cultivated lands around them had gone back to weeds, the black ashes blowing in the wind. Sean pointed at the ruins. "Renamo?" he asked, and his captors were outraged. "No, no," the sergeant told him. "Frelimo, Frelimo," and then he tapped his own chest. "Me, Renamo," he boasted, and pointed at his men. "Renamo, Renamo, Renamo," they agreed proudly. "Well, that settles that," Sean laughed. "Frelimo, bang, bang." He made the gesture of shooting a Frelimo, and they were delighted, joining in the pantomime of slaughter enthusiastically. Their attitude towards him improved even further, and at their next meal, the sergeant handed him an extra large cut of rotten meat. While he ate it, openly they discussed his performance to date, agreeing that he was acquitting himself admirably. "But," the sergeant asked, "he can run. And we know he can kill men, but can he kill a henshaw?"